All right, the next case of the morning is number 243754, Guidry versus Louisiana Department of Public Safety. And we'll hear from Mr. Harville when you get ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Douglas Lee Harville with the Harville Law Firm here on behalf of Mr. Kenneth Cotton's children. Your Honor, you have graced me today with 20 minutes to present my client's argument. That 20 minutes is particularly important to this case. One of the issues is the deliberate indifference to a medical need and to the health and safety of Mr. Cotton. Imagine someone seated in the back of this gallery for 22 minutes, two more minutes than Your Honors will give me. That person is clearly in visible severe pain. They are frequently vomiting.
Well, it looks as if his skull was basically bashed in.
It was.
To judge from the size of the wounds.
It was, Your Honor, and
so that was pretty visible.
It was extremely visible. Now imagine that as we're talking, as you're carrying on your activity with that person in the room, seeing that person. You know that a doctor is called in emergent orders. If you look at the timeline in this case, this incident happened at 12:06. The doctor ordered at 12:30 transport emergently. That's at record pages 546 and 547 in their expert report. Less than 20 minutes, the doctor made the determination this man needs emergency medical care. 22 minutes, they did not act on that.
He didn't get operated until 2 days later, right?
He did not, Your Honor. The craniotomy, the relieving of the pressure, but stabilization of blood pressure, IVs, all these things that emergency medical treatment can do, POFR can do, those are issues. And the conversation that we're having right now, Your Honor, is what is, I think, missing in a lot of these cases. We're not allowed under the law to disagree with medical treatment. We're not allowed to disagree with what we think would be the better course of care. We're not in this case, though. You have a doctor who says this man needs emergency medical treatment to a hospital for evaluation, and then no action. This is a no treatment case. Might we lose this at trial? We might. We don't know what the evidence is going to be. We don't know what the jury is going to find. But we do know that this is more than just disagreement with what they chose to do. It's how they did it. It's how they were trained to do it. It's a ticking clock. And if you read the medical notes are harrowing. As Your Honor said, clearly they knew that this was a Bastion skull.
Well, do you have any, where's your medical, I don't remember. Do you have medical evidence that had they gotten him to the hospital quicker, he would have survived?
Do not, Your Honor. And this is a case in which death occurred, but I don't think that death is a standard by which the medical neglect. It's a serious medical need, and it's an impact on that person. Imagine just alone the 22 minutes of pain and suffering, watching someone sit there in that kind of agony. This is a prison nurse. This is not a soft soul. These are prisoners. They're not soft souls. This man was, she notes, vomiting frequently.
Mr. Harville, you just pointed out that this was the prison nurse, but you've sued the warden. What evidence in the record is there of any personal involvement by the warden in the denial of medical care or the delay?
Your Honor, not arguably. In this case, I would argue that it's systematic and it's circumstantial. I would love to have had a case where Warden Goodwin was there at night. This incident occurred at 12 o'clock in that night. I think, though, in this case, and what my argument was, and why I think it's so succinct in this case, I think so many times these Eighth Amendment cases are the what if. We know someone died. We know you had a lack of medical care, but what else? And I think the what else is what you have here. You have a system where, what stopped it? Why was this going along? Could anyone possibly complain about the initial reaction? 5 minutes between when he was attacked and when the nurse was there. But it's when, if you read the nurse's note, at 12:40, she thinks that the control center has been notified. EMS is not notified for another 12 minutes after that, 22 minutes after the doctor's order. I think that this is, if you look at it and break it down in the number of failures that had to occur here, I think it's systematic and emblematic of that policy or procedure.
Did you allege a policy or procedure?
No. And that, not excusing thing, well, I'm not, it was not alleged, Your Honor. I think, though, that when you look at this case, what gets you to those, when you look at the cases and what they require, in this particular instance, it's such a systematic failure, such a complete and utter failure that I think here, circumstantially, there is enough. Is it thin? Yes. Would I have liked more? Of course. But it's not there. But I think when you look at that, and when I think that you look, and that's why I started with the reference to the audience. You've got all these people. You've got a nurse who is sitting there for 20 minutes. No indication she followed up.
But then why not sue the nurse if it's her deliberate indifference?
I would like to have seen a nurse sued, Your Honor. I did not draft the complaint. I was not there at the time this came on. I joined in at summary judgment. I think that we would have a much better claim against her. One of the reasons, though, why you have in a 1983 case, you cannot sue unless there's that action by the party. And I think when you look at this, not just in isolation, but look at all of the factors of this case. You have how Warden, in this case, you have in a deposition, Warden Goodwin say, oh, I'm not aware of us ever being sued for an attack by a lock before. He was currently being sued at the time of his deposition for that.
Let me ask you, assuming arguendo, you know, the facts are tough, to put it mildly, about the padlocks, et cetera, the injury, the death. Arguably, if you were suing for gross negligence or some kind of delictual matter, you might, you know, still be there. My question to you is, you know what the deliberate indifference standard is and so forth. So just succinctly articulate, what is the measure of deliberate indifference that, you know, you're wanting to persuade us, and as to which of the parties you sued?
Yes, Your Honor. For the deliberate indifference and focusing to now the failure to protect, you have what is deliberately indifferent in this is the what else. You have 1.2 to 1.3 attacks that you're allowed per year to not be deliberately indifferent. What else do you need to prove? Well, what we proved in this is that Warden Goodwin had allegedly discussions with his security staff, but then Lieutenant Cottrell couldn't remember having them. What else you have in this case is not what courts defer to, is the reasoned decision making of the jails. And you have throughout his deposition, Warden Goodwin attempting to say, I have that. What we have here at a summary judgment stage is we have opposition to that. He's saying we have deliberations about this, but that's not what Lieutenant Cottrell says. Lieutenant Cottrell says, we had discussions, but not about lock attacks. Warden Goodwin said, we haven't been sued, when in fact they were being sued. What you have is people
who— I understand you're saying to me there's a fact dispute. I got that part. You're saying it's a fact dispute, but my question was more, what is the conduct and by whom inaction that you're saying is not negligence or gross negligence, but is deliberate indifference within the meaning, you know, in order for you to prevail? Tell us that.
Yes, sir. I mean,
we've read the record, read the facts, and so forth. So,
in this particular case, it is Warden Goodwin who was sued for being deliberately indifferent. It is guiding over, in this case, is guiding over a prison and establishing policies that despite that surge in attacks, four in a year, an active lawsuit going on, knowing that an attack goes on, does nothing to mitigate that. And that's what, Your Honors, the case law and the facts in this are hard, because even a Supreme Court justice who was at a Circuit Court of Appeal has said there are legitimate penological interests that you need these locks in prisons. So we're going to defer to the courts and the decision-making of the policymakers. Warden Goodwin didn't do that in this case. Whenever you have an attack and you don't even know that there's a lawsuit, when you've given depositions in that, when you've given affidavits, and it has no effect on you, you can use the magic words, and that's what I would like this court to do and like to be done. You can use the magic words and you can say less than two attacks per year. You can use the magic words and say we have a policy. But when you can't in a deposition through discovery, and that's what plaintiffs did in this case, they did more than just make the allegations about the locks. They showed and had a deposition and had proof for it. They're saying the words. And if Your Honors and courts allow people to avoid liability by saying magic words, well, he's got the policy written, and that's what he did in this case, Your Honor. I think the facts show that in this case. The policy's there, but it's the application. And you have plaintiffs who, as Your Honor noted, could have done a better job with alleging or proving, but they went beyond the mere words that they showed through this deposition. You've got two of the leading proponents, two of the people who are going to make this prison safe or dangerous, who clearly aren't on the same page. Lieutenant Cottrell, in the affidavit I submitted for the prior involvement, which was at record page 658, he's the one who investigates these lock attacks. He's not just some random person who's not involved. He reports to the ward about what's done in these attacks. They say they've talked, but if you look at the deposition, the evidence is counter to that. The evidence is clear that there was no deliberation.
So exactly what was the deliberate indifference?
The deliberate indifference in this case was Warden Goodwin, despite knowing this, despite having the policies, despite what he said was a procedure to talk about and communicate about these attacks, which would be the only way you prevent them and you respond to them. If you look at what his deposition says, if you look at what Cottrell's, they weren't having that deliberation. That's what I would like to get to present to an honor, to a jury, Your Honor, and that's what I think we're entitled to.
Why is that? How does that rise to the level of deliberate indifference? Because for that, you have to have virtually, you know, a mental understanding that there is a serious risk presented, and you're saying there were four attacks in the previous year.
Yes, Your Honor.
So after the first attack, well, that's an anomaly. After the second attack, well, this inmate had it in for inmate B and everybody knew it, and that's why we're getting sued. I mean, Cottrell could have found that out. Third attack, he attacked him with a padlock and a shank. So do you blame the padlock, or do you blame the shank, or do you blame the perpetrator? I mean, I'm saying I don't know what's probative about the conflict that you see.
Your Honor, the conflict that I believe is probative and that I would point to is the fact there was no real deliberation in response to those. And I think especially in response to that spike, there's got to be proof that there was a deliberation. We have a material issue of fact. If you look at Cottrell, Lieutenant Cottrell.
That's not what Farmer versus Brennan says. Farmer versus Brennan is not a heightened negligence standard. It is a standard where, and that was an inmate-on-inmate attack, where they had reason to believe that the inmate A was going to be trying to attack inmate B. It has to be subjective knowledge of a threat. And I just say I'm not convinced you have evidence to create a fact issue that Goodwin had subjective knowledge.
And I appreciate the opportunity to discuss that with Your Honor, but I would ask you to look at this. The subjective and objective knowledge in this case is the fact you know, and he knows that you're going to have them. If, in his deposition, he's like, we know they're going to do it, but we know it will be worse if we don't have them. That's him saying the words to fit within Farmer to be excused for anything. And as long as he's allowed to do that and to use those magic words, there will never be any consequence for his decisions. In this case, you have someone who we have created a genuine issue of material fact. Maybe we can't prove it or not, but two of the people involved in the investigations are saying different things. One says we never, if you take Lieutenant Cottrell at his word, we never talked about lock attacks. We've got four attacks, Your Honor, as you noted, four attacks in a year, and they haven't talked about it. That's deliberate indifference. In the playoff, that they did not deliberate deliberately, because if they deliberate, then they have consequences. If they don't, if they just say, oh, I don't know, but we have policies, they get excused by the courts. So I'd ask Your Honors to find that's the difference in here.
Okay, thank you. You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Smith, Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Judge Jones, and may it please the court. This is a sad case, and the state doesn't shy away from that. But a prison official's duty under the Eighth Amendment is only to ensure reasonable safety, which incorporates due regard for the unenviable task of keeping dangerous men safe in custody. That standard reflects a human element, as prisoners often use ordinary objects as surprise attacks. And the law reflects that sad truism, as not every injury, including one as tragic as Mr. Cotton's death, translates into constitutional liability for prison officials responsible for the inmate's safety. To the best of our ability, we understand this case as raising supervisory liability claims against Warden Goodwin for the failure to protect, for inadequate medical care, and for the failure to train. There are multiple ways for this court to affirm, but the most straightforward is plaintiff's failure to establish supervisory liability for Warden Goodwin, which disposes of all three claims at once. Merits-wise, plaintiffs failed to establish any constitutional violation, which is how the district court ruled in this case, and I'm happy to walk through the analysis for each of the claims. However you see it, Warden Goodwin is entitled to qualified immunity, and the district court was right to grant summary judgment. I'll start with the lack of supervisory liability. The warden was not directly involved in this incident or in Cotton's medical care, so liability can attach to him only under a theory of supervisory liability. But plaintiffs failed to bring forward any evidence to support supervisory liability, so the analysis can and should end there. The court could also affirm for a lack of a constitutional violation on all three claims. I will start with a failure to protect. At bottom, plaintiffs are asking this court to turn a long-standing, commonplace security choice of allowing inmates to use padlocks to secure their property into a constitutional violation. But Farmer sets that test, and Justice Souter, who authored Farmer, later confirmed himself in Lakin that permitting padlocks, even when there is knowledge of prior attacks, falls well short of a constitutional violation under the Eighth Amendment. Every circuit court to address this issue has held the same. Plaintiffs were thus required to first show a substantial risk of serious harm and then meet the exceedingly high burden of proving deliberate indifference. And Farmer reminds us of two very important points that underscore this case. First, not every prisoner injury becomes a constitutional case. And second, officials who act reasonably are not liable even if a harm ultimately occurs. Here, there was no substantial risk of serious harm. Farmer explains that substantial means something objectively intolerable. And generally, this requires a long-standing and pervasive risk of harm that requires more than isolated events or the possibility of harm. Measured against that standard, the padlock theory doesn't pass Farmer's first step. Relevant case law is clear that issuing prisoners padlocks to secure their personal belongings does not create a serious harm. Start with Lakin. Again, Justice Souter, who wrote Farmer, concluded that allowing inmates to have padlocks was not unconstitutional. That's because the risk, even with prior incidents and a high spike of six assaults in a single year, was simply too insubstantial to state a claim. Our numbers bear that out. Padlock incidents were infrequent. Our numbers are about 1.6 per year on average, which is less than the Lakin average and includes 7 years of data after the incident and multiple years of zero attacks. That's exactly the kind of record that Justice Souter himself says is too insubstantial to satisfy his own Farmer Step 1. The Third Circuit reached the same conclusion in Beaton with one or two per year, and the Leon and Francisco case from Louisiana, as well as a slew of other district court cases from across the country, have found similar records too thin to support a constitutional claim. However you draw the line, this record sits well on the insubstantial side and fails Farmer's First Step. That's where the case could end. That means we never even reach deliberate indifference. But regardless, the record demonstrates that Warden Goodwin was not deliberately indifferent. This court knows that deliberate indifference is an extremely high standard to meet. It is akin to subjective recklessness. It cannot be inferred, even from gross negligence, as Judge Stewart pointed out, and it requires facts clearly evincing wanton actions. Nothing in the record supports that allegation. And more than that, Farmer is explicitly clear. Officials who reasonably respond to a substantial risk of serious harm cannot be liable. And here, allowing padlocks is a reasoned security judgment, and there is no evidence to the contrary. Padlocks and lockers secure property. They reduce theft, they lower tensions, and that's a legitimate penological interest to which this court should defer. Our expert agrees and has explained that the correctional center's approach mirrors common practice and professional guidelines. And almost every court to address this issue has agreed that padlocks do serve a legitimate purpose with the primary function of securing private property. Plaintiffs bring no evidence to the contrary. They do not offer their own expert. They offer no analysis, and they have no proof that Warden Goodwin knew of an objectively intolerable risk and ignored it. At the end of the day, this claim fails three times over. There's no supervisory theory to reach the warden, there's no risk of serious harm under Farmer's First Step, and there's no deliberate indifference in light of the reasonable, widely accepted policy. The district court got that claim right, and this court should affirm. I'll turn now to inadequate medical care. This one is very straightforward. The inadequate medical care claim must fail from the start. Cotton's medical care was performed by Nurse Benson and Dr. Fuller. Warden Goodwin was simply not involved. The plaintiffs never affirmatively linked the warden to Cotton's medical treatment or identify any policy or failure to train that caused the alleged constitutional violation. And my friend on the other side just said that they did not allege any policy about medical care. That ends the individual capacity claim, but I'm happy to walk through it on the merits if you would like that as well. If not, I will turn to the failure to train claim. Plaintiffs have nothing to support this claim. They merely state that constitutional violations have occurred, the failure to protect, and the inadequate medical care, and that those must have been due to a failure to train. Time and again, this court has said that such generalized statements are not enough for a failure to train claim. They've identified no training defect, and as Judge Jones explained in Roberts v. City of Shreveport, plaintiffs must allege with specificity how the training was inadequate in relation to the tasks the officers performed. Here, the plaintiffs don't do that. They just said that there was something wrong with the training and called it sufficient. At the end of the day, plaintiffs sued the wrong parties. They never pleaded supervisory liability against Warden Goodwin, and on the merits, they have offered no evidence of any constitutional violation, much less of deliberate indifference. Warden Goodwin is entitled to qualified immunity on all three claims, and the judgment should be affirmed. I'm happy to cede my time if the court has no questions.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
The defendants were, the warden was sued in his personal and official capacity, correct?
Yes, Judge Ramirez.
Did the district court address the official capacity claims?
No, the district court did not explicitly address the official capacity claims outside of the context of the failure to train claims. But officials in the state are not persons under Section 1983, so those claims must fail against the warden in his official capacity.
How do we handle that since the district court didn't address it?
Your Honor, that's based in sovereign immunity, and so you can raise it at any point in time.
But we are a court of review, not first view.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I believe that because it's rooted in sovereign immunity, that's immunity from suit, and so you could address it. But even if you don't address it, they still fail on the merits of all three claims, and so that could be an easier, more straightforward path.
So I hear you saying that we should rule on the issue as opposed to remanding it for the district court to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. Because I think the underlying lack of any constitutional violations is dispositive no matter what.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. I'll see my time.
I guess not. Thank you, ma'am. Okay, Mr. Harville.
Judge Ramirez, to address your last question that you addressed to State's counsel, I would ask that the matter be affirmed, conditionally affirmed, reversed, however you choose to do it. If you do affirm it, to conditionally affirm it, remand to the district court to take care of that last claim so there's not a federal claim hanging around. But I do not think it's something that your court as a court of error should address initially in this appeal.
You're saying we should affirm the district
court? Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to make sure I heard you.
Yeah.
You're saying we should affirm the district court?
No, Your Honor, that was a misstatement on my, regardless of how Your Honor's rule, I think that the matter of the official liability should be remanded. I certainly don't think you should affirm, Your Honor. And thank you for.
So I just kind of want to make sure.
Thank you for pointing.
It's clear on what you really meant.
Yes, no, Your Honor, I do not, and thank you for clarifying that. I apologize. Your Honors, I think that what is important here is to establish, and what this court can establish, is a static versus a dynamic view of what is deliberate indifference. If Your Honors affirm this matter, you are affirming a static version of deliberate indifference, in which policymakers can simply put the right things into the record, and as long as more than two people aren't attacked in a year, or four or five on average, or four or five in a year, they're fine. That's not what Farmer did. That's not what is done by Domino. They are giving and ceding freedom for the decision makers in these penological situations to make reasoned decisions. That's the dynamic portion of Farmer and Domino that I would like you to enforce. And in this case, there are genuine issues of material fact regarding that dynamic issue. We didn't just allege the number of attacks. We alleged, and I pointed out, contrast. You have one decision maker who says, we deliberated. You have another who said, we didn't deliberate in the face of these. And Judge Jones, I think that's what's important and vital in this case. It's that lack of deliberation in the face of four. It's the dynamic application of the principles in Farmer and Domino. They don't have that. The same thing in the depositions in this case with the lack of medical care. From a static standpoint, they say all the right things. It's not that hard to do. You're taught how to do it, you read Your Honor's cases, and you make the words and you say the words. But look in those notes. Look in the action, take a dynamic look at that. That's what they did in this case. That's what was presented for the summary judgment record. That's what should be allowed to go to a jury. As ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we agree. If you accept everything that they say and everything that the defense presents in this case, then they're right. Under Farmer, under Domino, they're entitled to qualified immunity and we lose. But if you look at what we pointed out, if you look at the evidence in this case, the disputed facts in this case, and apply those in a dynamic manner, and test those actions versus the words in the policy, you see that there was deliberate indifference.
How do you get it? I mean, you know, even assuming you were correct, how does that set up defying qualified immunity? In other words, no reasonable warden would have recognized a sufficiently serious threat from four padlock attacks.
And Judge Jones, I appreciate that point, and I think that's the key here. A reasonable warden, though, would have had deliberation, okay. Would have had a policy, and would have had some talk about it. And Lieutenant Cottrell says it didn't happen. Lieutenant Warden Goodwin in this case says, I don't know we're being sued. If you don't know that you're being sued for someone being beaten with the lock, is that really making a reasoned decision? I think it's untruthful, honestly, but I think that is a fact that should be given to a jury. Do you really, is him not knowing about a lawsuit, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is Lieutenant Cottrell saying they didn't talk about it? Is that a reasoned deliberation? Is that a policy? It's not. It is what you have in that medical. It's, we don't care. We're not going to have more than four of you beaten to death in a year, so we don't care. We'll just let it happen, and we'll get summary judgment. That's the difference in the dynamic. We pointed out more than just the allegations. We showed the inconsistencies. Please give us a chance to show those inconsistencies, those contested facts, to a jury. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you. Well.